Welcome back, everyone, for another deep dive. You've given us a lot to think about with this set of readings.
Right.
About the relationship between technology and society.
Uh-huh.
And, really focusing on how information systems can influence knowledge and power dynamics. It's a lot. The core source seems to be this excerpt from 4, Theoretical Perspectives on Technology.pdf.
It's pretty dense, gotta say. Academic stuff, but
Oh, yeah.
I think we can make it relatable, help people listening see why this theory stuff, like why it matters in everyday life.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's fascinating how often we just use all these complex information systems without even thinking about like where they came from or the assumptions behind them,
So it is like we're sleepwalking through this whole technological landscape.
Totally.
And these readings are like a wake-up call. I mean, they raise some really big questions, like, is technology really a neutral tool? Or is it shaped by social forces in ways we don't even realize?
Like, how does information actually become knowledge? And then, like, who gets to be in charge of that? Who gets to control it?
Yeah, and those are questions people have been debating for a long time,
Yeah.
and they're more relevant now than ever
Oh,
in
absolutely.
this tech-driven world we live in.
100%. Okay, so let's get into some of these ideas.
Okay.
This excerpt starts by kind of laying out these two traditional viewpoints on technology's role in society: voluntarism
Right.
and determinism.
Yeah.
So voluntarism sees technology as a neutral tool that we control. It's all about our choices and how we use it. Kind of like a blank slate, right?
Yeah, it's the idea that tech has potential. It
Right.
can be used for good, it can be used for bad. It all depends on,
Yeah.
us and how we decide to use it, our intentions.
Right.
But then you've got determinism,
Yeah.
and that flips that whole thing on its head. It suggests that technology is actually driven by, like economic forces, political forces beyond our control. So it's like technology shapes us, not the other way around.
Right. Like a chicken egg thing. Like, does
Yeah.
technology shape society or does society shape technology?
Yeah.
But this excerpt, and this is interesting, actually pushes back on this simple, like, either
Right.
with a what they call a contextualist approach.
Yeah, and contextualism is all about the interaction
Yeah.
between tech and society. So it's not just one or the other. It's this constant back and forth, this
Yeah.
interplay. And
Right.
if you want to understand the real impact of technology, you got to think about the social context, political context, economic
It's
context.
like trying to understand like a fish without thinking about the water it swims in.
Exactly.
Right? You can't separate the two. And speaking of context, historical context, this excerpt mentions this idea of technological optimism,
Oh, yeah.
which was this belief that technology is going to liberate us. It's inherently good. Like, think about the early days of the internet, all this talk about connection and information for everyone. It felt like we were about to enter a utopia.
It was a powerful idea. And to be fair, tech has led to some amazing advancements.
Yeah.
But I think, we've learned that it's not some guaranteed path to a perfect world.
Right.
In fact, all that optimism, it might have blinded us to some of the problems like the spread of misinformation and these echo chambers online.
And it makes you wonder, like, are we still sleepwalking
Yeah.
when it comes to technology? There's this quote from way back 1877 in this excerpt that says, "Technology must be perceived as an extension of our organs. With the help of these extensions, we gain the opportunity to develop ourselves intellectually, morally, and culturally. We acquire the opportunity to approach the utopias of human life." Do you buy that? Like, is tech really an extension of us?
It's definitely thought-provoking. I mean, on the one hand, technology has given us these incredible abilities and connected us in ways that we couldn't have even imagined 100 years ago, right?
Yay.
But to say that it automatically makes us better people, morally and culturally, I think that's a little naive.
Yeah.
It ignores all the ways that tech can be used for harm, too.
Right. So we've kind of established that tech and society are like really intertwined.
Yeah.
But let's look at some specific theories about how this relationship actually works.
Okay.
This excerpt talks about technological determinism, which is this idea that technology shapes society. Like, think about a loo's work, where technology creates this cycle where every problem leads to more tech.
Right.
Almost like we're on autopilot, just chasing the next fix.
Yeah, Lou's work is kind of a downer.
Yeah.
But he makes a good point. Technology can definitely build up its own momentum
Yeah.
and push social change in ways we don't expect, you know?
Yeah, like we're always playing catch up with all the unintended consequences.
Yeah, totally.
Then there's the reinforcement thesis by Danziger, which says that technology actually amplifies the power structures that already exist.
Right. So instead of like leading to some big revolution, technology often just keeps things the same.
Yeah.
It might make those hierarchies more efficient, but it doesn't really challenge them.
Have you ever seen that like in your own work? Where a new technology came in and, like, instead of making things more fair, it just made the people in charge even more powerful.
Oh, yeah. All the time.
Really?
It's a constant thing. Think about how information can be used to, like, control people. The higher-ups, they usually have more access to information, right?
Right.
And they have the means to spread it around, which just makes them more powerful.
Okay, so technological determinism is, well, it's pretty deterministic.
Yeah.
But then the excerpt goes into social constructivism, which has a different take.
Yeah.
It says that technology isn't predetermined. You know, it's shaped by the way different groups interact and how they see things. It's more like a collaboration where everybody brings their own perspective.
Yeah. And social constructivists, they emphasize the role of technological frames, which are like shared understandings. They shape how we design and use tech. It's not just about the tech itself. It's about the meaning we give it.
And those meanings can be totally different, right?
Like, yeah.
Like, there's that great example in here, the five different models for a central business register.
Right.
Each one reflects, like, a different group's vision.
Yeah.
It's amazing how the same technology can have such different interpretations.
That's what they call interpretive flexibility, where tech can mean different things to different people.
Right.
But the interesting thing is, one interpretation usually wins out.
Really?
They call that closure. Like in the CVR example, one specific design ended up taking over. That's how businesses are registered now.
So it's like this battle of ideas.
Kind of, yeah.
In one interpretation, it becomes the standard. But wait, so not everybody agrees with this whole social constructivist view, right?
Right. You've got Langdon Winner. He comes in and says, hey, we can't ignore power and influence.
Right.
They shape technology, too. Some groups have more say than others, and we don't always see those power dynamics. They're hidden.
It's like we're just blindly accepting how technology is changing our lives without asking, like, who's really benefiting?
Yeah. He calls it sleepwalking. We're sleepwalking through this tech revolution.
Yeah. And he goes on to say that technology is a political artifact.
Right.
Something that's designed to benefit certain groups.
And maybe even hurt others, intentionally or not.
Right. Okay, so we've gone from this, like, big picture view of technology and society to, like, a more nuanced way of thinking about how power is involved and how technology is developed and used. So now let's get even more specific and look at information systems, which, you know, are all about knowledge.
Right.
This excerpt gets into the difference between data, which is, you know, just raw symbols that don't really mean anything on their own, and information, which is data with context and meaning. Kind of like the difference between a pile of bricks and a house. Like, the bricks are just material. It's the design and the building process that makes them into something you can use.
Yeah, that's a perfect analogy. Data by itself is useless.
Right.
It's our knowledge that transforms data into something meaningful that we can use. Like, the excerpt quotes Flensburg, who says, "Tay-day is like ingredients. And information is like a recipe." It's the interpretation that turns raw data into something useful.
So it's not just about the data. It's about how we understand it.
Exactly.
And that brings us to Boisseau's model of coding and abstraction, which basically explains how we select and categorize information to make sense of the world.
Right. We take this complex reality and we create these simplified models that we can use to manage all that information. Like in that CVR example, where legal entities and production units, they become these abstract concepts that the system can handle.
Right. Like making a map of a huge area, right?
Totally.
The map isn't the actual area.
Right.
But it helps you navigate.
And it's important to remember that these models, these maps, they're just representations of reality.
Right.
And they always simplify things, and they always have some kind of bias built in.
Okay, so we're starting to see how knowledge itself is being shaped and categorized within these systems.
Yeah.
And that leads to a bigger question.
Yeah.
Like, how is knowledge itself shaped by social structures and power dynamics? We're going from technology to, like, sociology now.
Yeah, and this is where things get really interesting. Because you start to see how technology, knowledge, and power, they're all tangled up together in this web of relationships.
Right. So the excerpt brings in Daniel Bell's theory of the post-industrial society, where knowledge becomes the most valuable resource and information technology is the key to managing it all.
Right.
And he defines knowledge as organized statements about facts or ideas passed on in a systematic way, like separate from news or entertainment.
Okay.
Does that definition work for you? Like, is that all knowledge is?
I think it's a good start, but it's too narrow. Knowledge is more than just organized facts, right?
Right.
It's about understanding, experience, being able to actually use information in a meaningful way.
Right. And Bell's theory doesn't account for the power dynamics in how knowledge is created, you know? Like, who gets to decide what counts as knowledge?
Yeah.
Whose voices are heard, whose are silenced? These questions are important for understanding how knowledge works in society.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that the spread of knowledge is never neutral.
Right.
It's always influenced by power, by who's in charge, and who controls the flow of information.
Right. That's where Berger and Luckman's idea of socially constructed reality comes in.
Yeah.
It emphasizes how language and shared understanding shape what we even consider knowledge in the first place. Like, we create our own reality.
We do. Through our interactions and the stories we tell ourselves.
It's true.
About the world.
Their work reminds us that knowledge isn't objective or universal. It's shaped by our social context and the power structures around us.
So we've gone from thinking about tech as this neutral tool to seeing how it's really tied up with social forces, power dynamics, and even how we understand the world.
Yeah.
And it all comes back to, like, knowledge is power.
Absolutely. The people who control knowledge, they have a huge influence on how we see reality.
And that leads to Boisseau's typology of knowledge, which includes this really interesting idea of knowledge as property.
Oh, yeah.
It's this idea that codified, valuable knowledge can be controlled and traded, just like a product. Mm. It's like knowledge is becoming a form of capital in the information age.
That's a key point. In our information economy, knowledge is a valuable thing. It can be bought, sold, controlled, just like anything else.
Wow.
And the people who have the most valuable knowledge, well, they usually hold a lot of power, economic and political power.
So all these theories, they paint a pretty complex picture of this relationship between technology, knowledge, and power. But, like, what does this all mean for us?
That's the question we're going to explore in the next part of our deep dive. We'll look at how these abstract concepts play out in the real world, from organizations to, like, systems of government.
Stay tuned. All right, so in part one, we got pretty deep into, you know, some theories about technology, society, knowledge.
Yeah.
But, like, how does all this theoretical stuff actually play out in real life?
Well, get ready, because once you start to see these patterns, they're everywhere. Like, let's start with organizations, you know, workplaces, companies, any structured group, really.
Mm-hmm.
These readings, they highlight how information systems, they don't just make things more efficient. They actually shape the whole structure of an organization, like the culture of an organization.
So it's not just about, like, automating tasks. It's changing the power dynamic.
Exactly. Think about how something as simple as email, like, totally changed the way offices work. It created new bosses, new ways of working, new ways to, you know, get what you want.
So true. Like, who gets access to information? Whose emails are more important?
Exactly.
And don't even get me started on, like, information overload and email burnout.
Right. That's just one example, though. These readings make it clear. Information systems can be used to give more power to the top or spread the power around. They can make things transparent or keep them secret. They can make people work together or turn them against each other.
So, like, knowing all this, instead of just going along with whatever new system they put in at work, we should be asking questions like, what are they assuming when they design this?
Yeah.
Who is it actually good for? What kind of, like, work culture does it create?
Yeah.
It's like we need x-ray vision to see what technology is really doing.
I love that x-ray vision. And you need that even more when we start talking about government.
Ooh, okay.
This is where things get really serious.
So now we're talking about how technology affects, like, how we're governed.
Exactly. These readings, they're saying that information systems are not just neutral tools in the hands of the government.
Right.
They change the relationship between, like, regular people and the state.
Hmm. Like, how? Give me an example.
Think about all the surveillance tech out there. Governments are using super advanced information systems to watch what people are doing.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes it's for safety, like keeping people safe.
Right.
But it makes you worry about privacy, you know.
Yeah.
Civil liberties and, you know, whether they're going to abuse that power.
It's that balance between security and freedom.
Exactly.
We see it everywhere, like facial recognition, data mining, location tracking. Like, how can we use these powerful technologies without, you know, giving up our rights?
That is the million-dollar caution.
Yeah.
And these readings say we can't just assume that the government's going to use this stuff responsibly. We have to demand transparency, accountability. We have to be involved in making the rules about how this tech is used.
So it's not enough to just know about these things.
That we have to actually do something.
Exactly.
Push back against, you know, the government overreaching.
We need to know how they're collecting our data, storing it, using it.
Yeah.
We have to have a say in how it's all implemented.
Right.
And what the limits are.
It's like all that stuff we talked about earlier, voluntarism versus determinism.
Right.
If we're not careful, we'll just sleepwalk into this future where tech runs our lives.
Yeah.
Instead of us using it to make our lives better.
And it gets even trickier when you think about how information systems can be used to, like, change people's minds.
Oh, okay.
And affect politics.
Wait, like propaganda? Those misinformation campaigns you see online?
Yeah, but it's more subtle than that.
Really?
Information systems can control what information people see, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that shapes how they see the world,
right?
And what they believe politically.
It's like controlling the whole story.
Exactly.
Not just spreading lies, but, like, choosing what people get to hear.
Right.
How does that even work?
Yeah.
Well, think about the algorithms on social media, how they choose what shows up in your feed.
Yeah.
They're designed to show you things you'll like, but that can create these echo chambers where you only hear from people who agree with you.
Right. And it's not just algorithms.
Right.
There's also powerful people or groups trying to silence other voices.
Exactly.
So you don't get to hear the other side of the story.
Right. And when that happens, it's easy to manipulate people.
Yeah.
Make them believe what you want.
So, like, what can we do about this? It feels like we're up against these huge invisible forces.
It can feel overwhelming.
Yeah.
But the first step is awareness. We have to be critical about the information we see online. Mm-hmm. Always asking, who's saying this? Why are they saying it? What are they not telling me?
It's like we need a built-in BS detector.
Exactly. Be skeptical, look for different perspectives, and be willing to, like, question your own beliefs.
Right.
And support organizations that are fighting misinformation and protecting our rights online.
This is getting pretty personal.
Yeah, it's not just theory anymore.
Right.
It's about, like, my everyday life, the choices I make online, what I'm reading, and the kind of world we're all creating with those choices.
That's a powerful realization. And it's just the beginning. We haven't even talked about the ethical stuff with AI and data privacy.
Okay, let's get into that. What are some of the ethical problems hiding beneath the surface of these technologies? Okay, so we've talked about how information systems are shaping, like, organizations and governments. But now let's get into the really, like, mind-bending stuff.
Yeah.
Artificial intelligence and data privacy. I feel like we're on the edge of, like, some huge breakthroughs, but also some big ethical problems.
It's true. These technologies are changing so fast.
Yeah.
It's hard to even know what their full impact's going to be, let alone, like, figure out all the ethical stuff.
Right. AI is everywhere, right? Our phones, our cars, healthcare.
Yeah.
It's amazing, but also kind of scary. What are some of the, like, biggest ethical worries that these readings bring up? Well, one of the big ones is algorithmic bias.
Yeah.
You know, AI systems, they learn from huge amounts of data.
Mm-hmm.
And if that data has bias in it, like reflecting existing societal biases,
right,
the AI just continues those biases,
right,
makes them even worse.
It's like that saying, garbage in, garbage out.
Exactly. You feed an AI bad data, you get bad results.
Yeah.
And this can have real consequences, like in the justice system, hiring, getting loans, even healthcare. We've already seen AI systems that discriminate against certain groups, you know, based on things like race or gender.
That's really messed up. It's like we're building these tools that could make inequality worse.
Yeah.
Instead of helping us make a fairer world.
That's why it's so important to have a variety of people developing these systems.
Yeah.
People who understand bias and who want to build fairness into the design from the start.
So it's not just about the tech itself. It's about the people making it.
Right.
And their values. We need to ask who's building these AI systems, what data they're using, and how are they preventing bias from, like, sneaking in.
Totally. We can't just hope that these technologies will be used for good. We have to be involved.
Right.
Make sure they're aligned with, you know, our values as a society.
Okay, so AI is a big one.
Yeah.
What about data privacy? It feels like all our personal info is being collected, analyzed everywhere we go online.
Yeah.
Is this just the price we pay for, like, living in a digital world?
Well, that's something a lot of people are asking.
Yeah.
But these readings, they argue that data privacy is about way more than just, like, personal convenience or protecting your credit card number. It's about the foundations of democracy.
So it's not just about me as a person.
No.
It's about, like, all of us as a society.
Exactly. Think about how easily data can be used to manipulate people, control them, even silence them.
Yeah.
Think about how mass surveillance can, like, shut down free speech. People are afraid to speak out if they think they're being watched.
It's almost like we're sleepwalking into a surveillance state.
All right.
Big Brother is always watching. And it's not just governments doing it.
No.
Companies are collecting tons of data on our habits, our preferences, where we go.
Yeah.
It's kind of creepy.
It is. And that's why we need strong laws to protect data laws that give people control over their own information. We should be able to decide what's collected, how it's used, and who can see it.
It's like we need a digital bill of rights.
Yeah. Like,
you know, rules that protect our privacy and our freedom in this digital world.
Absolutely. And we got to fight to protect those rights. We can't just give up our privacy because it's convenient or because they say it's for safety. We need to know what companies and governments are doing with our data.
Right.
And hold them accountable when they misuse it.
So, like, where do we go from here? We've covered so much in this deep dive. It's a lot to process.
It is. But remember, knowledge is power. The more we understand these issues, the more we talk about them. And demand better from the people in charge, the better chance we have of creating a future where technology helps humanity.
Right.
Not the other way around. It's not about rejecting tech. It's about using it wisely, ethically.
This deep dive has really opened my eyes.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how much I just took technology for granted.
And that's a great first step.
Yeah.
Once you start seeing the world this way, you can't unsee it.
Right.
And hopefully it'll make you want to be more involved, you know, a more informed citizen, someone who's actually shaping the future of tech, not just letting it shape you.
Well said. And to our listener, we hope you keep thinking about these things. Read more, ask questions, don't just accept what you're told. Talk to people about this stuff. The future of technology is not set in stone.
Right.
It's something we create together through our choices, our values, what we do.
Stay curious. Stay engaged. The stakes are high.
Yeah.
But there's so much potential, too.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.